This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 7th of June 2011, our main speaker was Dr. Bruce Littleboy of the University of Queensland. He spoke on the subject of GLS Shackle, Can We Reconcile the Irreconcilable? And you can download slides to go with his presentation from the PKSG website.
Well, thank you, Mark, and good evening to you all. I might begin where Roger Backhouse left off, in a sense, last week. Last week, the issue was about the legitimacy of those who interpret Keynes and their claims to represent the true Keynes and so forth. And Joan Robinson famously remarked that there were too many bastard Keynesians around, and the implication was that it would be better if true blood Keynesians were put in positions of authority. It's an interesting metaphor. I like to take metaphors seriously and run with them a little bit. The interesting thing about bastard progeny versus legitimate progeny is that each of them have a certain number of genes from the parent, in this case the same, 50-50 split, but it's not clear whether the bastard progeny are going to be more or less fit than the legitimate ones. Legitimacy is a social convention. It doesn't mean that what you're producing is going to be any better or worse than the parent. So it could well be that if it's 50-50 from Keynes, it may well be which 50 is inherited. And there's some wisdom from Sir Winston that I might refer you to. There's a story, joke, whatever you want to call it, that probably apocryphal, that a woman went up to Sir Winston and said, "Oh, Sir Winston, I should have your baby. It would have my looks and your intelligence." And he replied, "Madam, it may well have my looks and your intelligence." And my point, of course, is that if you're going to hybridise Keynes and mix and match, as it were, you may end up with the wrong halves. And another insight there from Winston Churchill. So tonight is something along a continuum of what these seminars are about, namely exploring Keynes and where he leads and where he comes from. And it could be that hybrid vigour is more important than purity of the genetic bloodline. And it could also be that a number of interpreters of Keynes regard Keynes himself as having some traits that are better bred out, so that the purest and best elements of Keynes should be preserved and other genes quietly excluded. So there are some people who want the true Keynes, a kind of a clone, try and map the true genetic structure of Keynes. Other people want to get to the essence of Keynes, get rid of all the extraneous bits and go, in fact, further than Keynes did, even more Keynes than Keynes. And it's possible that our star tonight, George Shackle, could fit into that category, whereas other people just want to go beyond Keynes to say, well, Keynes said some things, let's see where we can go. Now, George Shackle has been described fairly famously by Alan Coddington as a fundamentalist, as one of the fundamentalists. Indeed, Joan Robinson is also picked up in that description. Fundamentalist is someone who looks at the general theory and regards it as containing great insights that should be passed on to future generations. And the core components of the general theory are those which require further transmission, and there are other conflicting passages that perhaps are less important and should be read down in the light of the important passages. Now, George Shackle left clues for us about what he believes, and on his own tombstone he composed a poem, which presumably he may have meant for that very purpose, his own prayer, in fact. O Lord, I beseech thee, shape my thought to beauty. And that's not just a stray remark. Obviously, you don't put stray remarks on your own gravestone. It meant something to him. The centrality of beauty and its quest in the life and writings of George Shackle. And that devotion to beauty, as well as devotion to Christianity and the Christian God, I think shapes what George Shackle had to say, we have to look at the man himself and not just the text. The author helps you provide the meaning for a text. Now, I may as well be upfront and say what I think my conclusion is. My conclusion is that George Shackle was a Christian Neoplatonist, and you should read his thought in that light. Now, Christian is a no-brainer, because he was, everyone knows that, and everyone says what a nice, humble, decent fellow he was, and he was devoted to his church and a functionary there and so on. But the point about Neoplatonism may be obvious as soon as I say it, but when you're looking for sparks that suggest it, you'll very quickly encounter. It's very hard to flick through a book of Shackle's without things lighting up off the page, if you're looking for them and primed. Now, there are parts of Shackle's writings where he's lyrical and poetic, and you might even say to the point of mystical in some of his more mysterious utterances, but there is this pervading sense that beauty is something that you seek, and that beauty is a pathway to truth, and I think he may have been captured by that insight and perhaps led astray, as perhaps mystics always are, by the power of a core insight. The passage there from Roger Garrison on slide 4 for the potties. The lens becomes more like a mirror. The lens through which George Shackle viewed the world becomes a mirror that lets us look at George Shackle. Now, I'm going to be looking at the relationship between style and substance. Style actually helps you ascertain what the message is. Style is not just happenstance in terms of the way somebody happens to express him or herself. The meaning of the prose and the way it is written are entwined. Now, Alan Coddington, the man who labelled Shackle a fundamentalist, was described in turn by Shackle as a classicist, somebody who liked the standard way of doing economics, clean, austere, elegant, cut down in mathematical form, sparse with prose, whereas Shackle and Keynes were thick with prose and lyricism and metaphor. Now, you cannot translate prose readily into austere mathematics. Things will be omitted, and it's those things that are omitted in mainstream economics that Shackle regards as integral. Now, to pursue the artistic metaphor, Keynes is a romantic, and Coddington is a lover of the austere beauty of lines and curves in perhaps classical architecture, for example. But the punchline is this. Shackle says that in terms of painting, Keynes was a Turner, not a Canaletto, which invites this. Let's compare the two. These are, well, similar scenes from Venice. Left is, well, you don't really need to be an art historian to know that the one on the left is painted in a rather more romantic, lush and emotional style than the one on the right. The one on the right is almost photographic, a clear light. The environment is in some sense under control. Now, the Romantics were inspired to some extent by William Wordsworth, the poet, and my understanding, I may be wrong, is that until Wordsworth, people did not regard, well, Western Europe, did not regard nature as a thing of beauty, still less something that you'd want to paint and celebrate and dramatise. It was something you'd want to just avoid. You didn't want to go in the mountains. Mountains were remote places away from civilization. Well, there we have a stark example of a Turner, a dramatic Turner on the left. But my argument can be forwarded, I think, by a painting of Canaletto's. If you get onto a website of Canaletto's, you'll see hundreds, it seems, of Canaletto's with starkly different styles. The classical style that Shackle pointed to, and something remarkably more Turner-esque. So Turner certainly did not invent the Turner style. The clouds are angry and emotional, whereas the front of the scene with the people, that's much more photographic and realistic and clinical. And in one painting, I'm suggesting, you can capture two styles. the austere, the classical, and the romantic. But you have to be skillful. But in this case, it's almost done in half, the bottom half classical and the top half romantic. And so that this painting struck me. And it's something I think that Shackle could think about as well. Now, not everyone in this room knows necessarily about George Shackle and what he wrote. His main claim to fame among post-Keynesians, anyway, is that he wrote about the general theory, Keynes's general theory. And there was one aspect of the general theory that Shackle had trouble with, a kind of Keynes problem for Shackle, that the book talked about human choice and the human condition and how individual people had to make decisions shrouded in deep uncertainty. They did not know what was going to happen. They did not have some algorithm that would generate the future. So they had to imagine what the future may be. They would have hopes and fears that would colour the way in which they would make decisions, and they would not make their decisions as if they were rational, clinical, classical calculators of benefits and costs. And that's certainly a core component of the general theory so far as the instability of long-period expectations is concerned. So far as individual people are concerned, and including individual decision-makers in the economic domain, expectations are inherently restless and volatile because a slight change in circumstance or in the news can cause a transformation or reconfiguration of how people imagine the future may turn out. And this will affect their confidence in making decisions in share markets and in the context of business investment and long-term investment projects. The problem for Shackle in Keynes is that much of the general theory is written in terms of mechanics. He has a model. He has things that are either written as equations or readily turned into equations that can be simultaneously solved. And you move from one equilibrium position to another. And Shackle is rather concerned that you have a state of expectations at point one. Expectations change, as expectations do, and then in a twinkling of an eye, a new equilibrium is generated mathematically. Given these new expectations, here is your new equilibrium value for output and income and employment. And Shackle is thinking, how can you graft these two visions of the world, in a sense, together on one canvas? So why is Shackle critical? I think there are intellectual grounds that I'll quickly go through, but I also think there are aesthetic grounds for Shackle, finding unease with the way Keynes writes the general theory. And I think everyone's been focusing on the intellectual side and not realising just how driven Shackle is by the aesthetic. And indeed, most of his life's work doesn't make sense if you don't appreciate that he's on an aesthetic journey. And is Shackle himself open to criticism? Well, he gives intellectual and aesthetic reasons for why he disagrees with Keynes, but I think counter-arguments are possible on both fronts, and I'll give you an outline of what I think they may be. Well, as I mentioned, here's the Keynes problem, which Shackle describes as an arresting contrast between method and meaning. And arresting is a word that Shackle uses, by the way, in other contexts. It's not just a casual word. It's what he uses as part of his theory of human choice. People look at the arresting features of the world and focus on them rather than do a complete cost-benefit study of every conceivable eventuality. So the world is filtered and selected. And Shackle almost parodied what Keynes had to say by saying that it's as if Keynes was describing a tableau vivant. Now, tableau vivant is a very old-fashioned pre-television and radio event. It would happen on the stage, it would happen in churches and royal celebrations as well. But essentially, it's people perhaps acting out some classical Greek moment in classical Greek stories or fables. So, and people would be frozen in an animated state. Now, Shackle was saying it's rather like having tableau number one. Here we have a full employment equilibrium. And then the curtain closes, and then there's much bumping and shuffling around, and then the curtain opens again, and here we have another scene. And you were meant to just imagine for yourself how the process went from one to the other. So Shackle was, in a sense, quiet, too quiet for Shackle's liking, on the process of transition. Now, it occurred to me, I wonder why in the 1930s Shackle was thinking of Tableau Vivants. Well, you may have heard of the Windmill Theatre, which began in the 1930s, and the Windmill Theatre was when ladies in a state of semi-dress or undress would form tableaus. And, of course, this was art. This wasn't erotic entertainment. Oh, no. It's art because they're frozen. It would be lewd, however, if they were allowed to move, and that's why the censors let the Windmill Theatre operate in this way. Well, Shackle was in his 30s, I think, at that stage. Maybe he read the newspaper. Oh, that previous slide was tastefully cropped. And I playfully think that I doubt that Keynes did not provide the dynamics because the motion would be lewd. The metaphor does break down. But Shackle, I think, had a different conception of the way economies operated from Keynes himself. He refers to the kaleidic view of the world. And a kaleidic view, it's a famous metaphor of his, it's the metaphor of the kaleidoscope, where you would view the world, in this case the universe would be the shards of glass, crystals of glass, and the merest turn of one end of this telescope-looking device would cause the glass to tumble and reconfigure in a new, interesting and beautiful pattern. So it would be a sudden transformation of patterns. Now, Shackle argued that the world around us is not really an equilibrium system or a mechanism. In fact, the coherence we observe in the world is largely illusory, and he suggests that that coherence is leads to a state of affairs which has some public air of being generally coordinated. So he is not a man who thinks that economies spontaneously and powerfully coordinate themselves. There is a mere air of coordination about them. And this is what troubled him a bit about Keynes, and possibly about Hayek as well. Hayek has a very powerful tendency for coordination in his capital theory, but this is not a talk about Hayek. And I think that Keynes had more respect for the coordinating powers of markets than perhaps Shackle did. At least Keynes said, look, I'm relaxed about orthodox microeconomics. Markets solve microeconomic problems pretty well. It's the macro that I'm concerned with. Well, Shackle obviously would not go as far as that. He even thinks that microeconomic order is rather ephemeral and restless and transient. I don't think it's very true to Keynes, though. Shackle would view the world as a... How would he model the world if he did model it? He would model it as cataracts and pools where the system would tumble from one state to another state. Violence would be sudden, but a new resting place would be brief, and then this tranquility would soon be upset by another tumbling series of changes. So he uses terms like landslides. I found three or four references to landslides in his scheme of economic theory. It's not a stray metaphor, in other words. My argument is that maybe Keynes meant what he said, and he wasn't mixing clumsily uncertainty and machine. He actually meant what he said. Now, Keynes argued that there is some measure of stability in the world, and it's provided by conventions. In other words, the world can sit still long enough, expectations can sit still long enough for mechanical processes to work. By mechanical processes, one would be the Keynesian multiplier, where if you're unemployed, you can't afford consumption goods, producers of consumption goods produce less consumption goods, there's more unemployment, blah, blah, the system moves further and further away in a fairly predictable manner, mechanical manner, one that you can write an equation down for. Now, these conventions that Keynes listed in 1937 to clarify his meaning, he said, one, we deny the future exists. Now, Shackle, of course, says, oh, we worry about the future, we wrestle with the future, we imagine it, we hope, we have fears. But Shackle was saying, oh, most of the time we ignore the future. pretend it isn't there. That's our defence mechanism number one against worrying about uncertainty. The other is we just pretend that the future can be the present can be extrapolated into the future unless we've got some clear reason to expect a change. And the third is we look around and see what everyone else is doing. And we say, well, they seem to know what they're doing, I'll just follow the herd. Shackle, on the other hand, thought that conventions were fragile and restless. They were just momentary resting points, and you couldn't bear an argument. They couldn't bear the burden of providing stability to a macroeconomic system. But Keynes, I think, clearly did give them that role. And I think Keynes obviously thought that economies could remain stuck in pessimistic states or in states where conventions were long-lived to the point where you could have long-lived slumps. You could be stuck. Now, this runs counter to the fleeting transience of equilibrium that George Shackle thought was integral to the vision of uncertainty. Shackle also doesn't say much about institutions and how they provide some structure within which people can operate with greater confidence in an uncertain world. Keynes, of course, wanted to get on top of the system and master institutions and run them properly. Shackle is institution thin and individual strong. So according to Shackle, there were the problems that you have equilibrium given such centrality in the general theory, and yet uncertainty is given such centrality as well. He, Shackle, can't see it, whereas I'm suggesting that if you take convention seriously, the two can be resolved. Now, Shackle was saying that there's a problem, that tableau vivant problem in the general theory, that Keynes could have filled in the gaps and could have filled them in rather consistently with his own mechanistic vision, but for some reason he didn't. For those of you who are in the trade, you would know about the dynamic multiplier, and the dynamic multiplier is not something that Keynes relied on in the general theory, at least in its theoretical structure. He relied on an instantaneous multiplier. He just said you jump from one equilibrium to the other without further comment. But Shackle was saying, why didn't he rely on what the Swedes were talking about in the 1930s, namely how you can have that effect I spelt out earlier, that people go and buy more consumption goods and consumer good producers say, oh, the orders for consumption goods have gone up, I think I will produce more. And in the next production period, they hire more workers to produce more consumption goods, and those workers go out and produce consumption goods, and then they go and spend their income, and the process is a cascading or tumbling effect to get to the new equilibrium point. Shackle thought that it would have been more consistent to Keynes's vision, or aesthetically more pleasing to Shackle, if he had at least spelt out the mechanism, or at least done a proper job with the mechanism, instead of the shoddy job that he did with his snapshots. I think I should defend Keynes from Shackle's tantalising comments. We don't often, or exegetes don't often draw a distinction as we might between statements that are meant heuristically versus statements that are meant epistemically. Well, that's just fancy talk. A heuristic statement is something that I say for teaching purposes. If I'm trying to explain to you how macroeconomics works, I might say, well, suppose this happened, that would cause this to happen. Okay, I'm dumbing it down for you to understand the basic processes at work. I don't really believe that this applies in the world. I'm just making it simple for you, in brackets, possibly for me as well, to understand and get my head around. And that's the basic model, and then, well, okay, we'll introduce more refinements as you get smarter. And I'll make the story more complicated. So it's natural for people to take shortcuts. So the tableau vivant may just be a heuristic shortcut, not some kind of necessary belief that the world, in a twinkling of an eye, the multiplier can operate and employers will immediately jump from one output position to another. That's not necessarily what Keynes meant about the world. It may have been, look, I'm just taking some shortcuts here to get from A to B as quickly as I can. Economists often make what we call ceteris paribus assumptions. We hold things constant to keep things simple. Well, Keynes may have done it rather brutally, too brutally for Shackle's liking, but it's still a legitimate procedure. It's not a contradiction to make ceteris paribus assumptions, and indeed to relax them later on. Keynes assumed, money wages are given. Doesn't mean he believed that. It was just a way of letting the argument run and get sensible outcomes from it. And then in another chapter he says, what if we make them perfectly flexible? Then different things happen. Now, in the real world, you guys realise that the truth lies in between the two, and you're meant to calibrate the argument. You've seen the two extremes. You know the world is between the two extremes, so work it out for yourselves. Do I have to spell everything out for you guys? Well, maybe that is what I'm suggesting Shackle... that's how Shackle approached the general theory, as a heuristic or teaching device, rather than claims about how the world worked that are carved in granite. Now, the model in the general theory is very hard to identify and exposit. Mark, of course, spends his life doing exactly that and finally reading what he thinks the true message is, and this is the model. At last I have found it. And here is me saying, it's just heuristic anyway, Mark. Don't take it too seriously. I'm playful, of course. So I'm suggesting that maybe Shackle has missed Keynes's heuristic point. Although Shackle may be right in saying, gee, it would have been nice if Keynes had spelt out the transitional process a bit better, and maybe he could have talked about the inequality of saving and investment and how they came into equality through time, like he did in his earlier book. Well, maybe. I want to move on to what I've mostly been doing here, and that's reading Shackle's Scheme of Economic Theory. And that's what I've been doing, I suppose, for the last couple of weeks. And his Scheme of Economic Theory is a way in which he, Shackle, tries to resolve what might be thought of as disharmony in the history of economic theory. We have all kinds of theories that come at the problem from different angles and have different styles and different assumptions and have different fan clubs associated with them. And most people can think in some terms, but they just don't like input-output analysis, or they're general equilibrium people and they just can't get the vibe of other forms of economics. And Shackle's argument is essentially, baldly, this. All of these creations are creations of great artists. All the great thinkers who have produced these models, whether we like them or not in terms of their value and power to explain the world, these are beautiful constructions, and we should respect them as works of art and have an aesthetic appreciation of them. So we can have a kind of art gallery of great models in art, and we can appreciate all of them. And then it's a separate question as to which of these models we would use to solve a problem. But let's have a group hug. I think there's a bit of Christianity in here that let's all love each other. But there's also an aesthetic one. All works of art are beautiful in their way. We can compose a beautiful gallery of art, and we're not forced to say that one is better than the other. And he's not trying to reconcile these things logically. He's reconciling them at some aesthetic level. He's saying they're all beautiful in their way. We can't have a model that simultaneously is a Leontief model, a general equilibrium model, a Keynes model, and so on. Logically, they're incompatible. So he's not trying to synthesise them. He's trying to say that we can understand their contributions and where they fit in relation to each other, by looking at how they relate to time. Now, on slide 17, I've got another quote. We're not trying to build an omnicompetent model. We're trying to explain how these can simply sit together, even though their assumptions mutually repel each other. So he's fusing them non-logically. In other words, intuitively. You're apprehending... Now, what themes can we use to apprehend these models? He argues that you can understand them in terms of the way in which they approach time. There are two types of time, Shackle argues, in economics. There is expectational time and there's mechanical time. Expectational time is time as lived by the participant, by the individual, and this individual typically is confronted by uncertainty. So it's from the point of view of the person who is making decisions inside the world. So you're trying to emphasise or put yourself in the position of the actor. These models of the world tend to be open-ended because human choice of such people is open-ended and not predetermined. So outcomes are indeterminate. Whereas another type of model, the ones that tend to prevail in mainstream economics, of course, are machine-like. They are where an outsider understands the model of the world and can crank out the answers. So the answers are determined by the parameters and by the equations. It's a closed system because there's one answer. And the detached observer is, of course, like God, who knows everything that is going to happen in the history of this model, knows the starting point, you know the end point, you know the history in inverted commas. It's purely a logical exercise to get from A to B, from the start of the clockwork to the end of it. And he plots various creations on a diagram in terms of their reliance on the two respective concepts of time. Well, we obviously can't talk about all of these, but the interesting two are K and N. K refers to Keynesian kaleidostatics, and the term kaleidostatics is a kind of Zen fusion. Kaleidic is about the tumbling change of the world, but yet he's rather snootily saying, well, Keynes, of course, brutally made it static by turning it into tableau vivant. So his meaning, kaleido, and his mechanism, static, subverted each other. But so rather cruelly, I think Shackle refers to point K as kaleidostatics. And point N refers to non-distributive expectation, which means that you can't put them on a normal distribution curve, essentially. And you read a footnote, oh, N, who says this, who has this theory, N? Two books by G.L.S. Shackle. So in the great panoply of great artists, of models that we need to understand, of course, appears the writings of G.L.S. Shackle. Now, I have to accept Shackle's invitation and call this kaleidodynamics. I mean, he's teed it up so that I'm left with no choice. The reader can't really do anything else. And then Shackle goes on to say, well, all I've done is put these on a diagram and put them in a scheme so that you can appreciate the nuances of all of them. Oh, by the way, I should mention something interesting about that this diagram, is that a couple of the coordinates are 7, 0, but some of them are things like 5, 3 and 6, 2. They don't necessarily add up to 7. Which raises the fascinating possibility that you could have something 7-7. Shackle doesn't consider that a surprising possibility, and I find it hard to imagine how this would be done, but gee, that'd be a great theory if you can get a 7-7. And then he goes on to say that, look, just because I've said this theory has this blend and this theory has the other blend, I'm not saying anything about their value to economists or their power to explain the world. I'm just saying that here is an interesting way of reconciling intuitively where these models fit in the gallery. I think that's a little disingenuous, really. I mean, if you put something in a gallery and say, well, here we have these wonderful works and here we have these other wonderful works, aren't you really saying, well, we have models that are realistic and confront time as it is lived, and then we have all these other silly models that are really wrong because they're closed and the mechanical. And, of course, we have these models that must be right because they're based on basic facts of the world upon the kaleidic worldview. You really can't say that this is just a democratic spread. It's loaded the way that I think his scheme is loaded so that his end of the spectrum, the Keynes, the KN look end of the spectrum, really does well. And here I want to change gear rather clunkily. Shackle is concerned with beauty and coherence and order, not in the economy, but in the way we think about the economy, in our minds. And I've already indicated that he's Christian, and I've already indicated that he is enamoured of beauty, and I've already given the clue that, well, if it quacks like a duck, he's a Christian Neoplatonist. Neoplatonism has a significant history at Cambridge, by the way, but it has a significant history through Christendom, frankly. The two are binary stars. Now, if you're looking for Christian Neoplatonist-sounding statements, suddenly they light up off the page. This is from Years of High Theory. This is slide 21, page 286. Insight into the thing in being. Now, I'm sure I've read that term in some Christian mystic-type stuff, so I thought, oh, yeah, better check it up on Google. And it's rather hard to find, but eventually you'll find that it's got something to do with the transcendental and the eternal. So, and he had it in italics, so he was using it in an economics book in italics. I mean, the evidence is in plain view, hidden in plain view, I might say, because people haven't noticed the obvious. They've all talked about his relationship with Keynes and his as a historian of thought, and they haven't seen the naked...
Which page is that?
Page 286 from High Theory. And I've put some letters in that are in lowercase in bold to indicate that if you put them in uppercase, he's talking about God. He's talking about the ultimate, the absolute, the thing in being. And he goes on. Oneness. Its presence. I mean, this is straight from some theological tract. I haven't, of course, been able to identify what theological tract this is, but to me this is just generic Christian mysticism. Inborn longings, inspired convictions. Hello? I mean, do you need dancing girls? I mean, this is so obvious and blatant that... This informs his worldview, his vision of and how he conceives of his work. But there's more and more. Choice. Why is he so keen about individual choice and the choices that confront people in an uncertain world, the crucial choices that we make that affect our lives? Well, it means that we're responsible as human, dignified human beings. This is very consistent with a Christian view of how people are. They're not machines. They are people who can make individual acts of free will for which they will be responsible. And I really think, although I haven't spelt it out in the paper, that when Shackle talks about salient alternatives, the most attractive alternative and the most unattractive alternative, and you weigh the two up, oh, gee, if I do this, the best that could happen is this and the worst that could happen is that, he's talking about heaven and hell. I mean, clearly. Now, if I do this, I might go to heaven. If I do this, I might go to hell. Those are the salient, arresting alternatives that we make in other choices. And the word hope appears a lot in Shackle. A totally pre-reconciled world is a world where your choices don't make any... have the slightest effect whatever. But, of course, in an open-ended world, they do. And you imagine things and you... act in hope. You can't let uncertainty get you down and become a nihilist. Now, I'm going to assert that Shackle is the only social scientist who used hope as an analytical concept, and you'll find hope embedded in his theory of crucial decision-making. Hope and imagination are there as analytical steps in his argument. I won't go into that tonight. I find the analytical argument actually quite difficult. And in a title in an article entitled A Student's Pilgrimage, hello, he refers to an author as Elizabeth Bowen, and the second Elizabeth is spelt with an S wrongly, and he talks about fate and chance. This is slide 25 from his Banco de Lavoro paper. And Elizabeth Bowen is a novelist, and I've checked her out thoroughly. Peter Earle tells me that there are others that have the same sort of approach that Bowen does. From the same piece, he refers to expectation and the originative gift. Now, origination is, of course, godlike. So Adam and Eve are conferred with the power of originative free will on Earth. So we're mini angels. This is Christianity 101. Dazzling light, well, that's Christian mysticism 101. 201 is the dazzling darkness, by the way, but I haven't encountered any passages to that effect in Shackle. I reckon that he read some Meister Eckhart and or some Teresa. The language is just so much like it. I haven't got a smoking gun. I haven't been able to contact the relatives to say if he was, ask him if they were, he was always banging on about Meister Eckhart. But... and I hope to talk to some people who knew him well who may still be able to tell me this. But Shackle has been called a nihilist because he denies economic order. He says the world is uncertain, it's unpredictable. Well, what does that mean we can operate? Where people have actually accused him of being a nihilist. Now, and it's almost a sport, it's a very common accusation that he's a nihilist. Now, if you're a Christian, A, a Christian, and B, a Christian Neoplatonist, it's a ludicrous thing to say about someone. And Catherine, his widow, was rather grisly, and Roy Rotheim correctly drew this to our attention long ago. Now, Alan Coddington, our friend, described Keynes's theory of the speculative demand for money as the economics of pure chaos. Now, this is a shot at Shackle, because this is one of the parts of general theory that he, Shackle, thinks is wonderful. Chaos, pure chaos, this is hell. This is the world without God. I mean, you fire those sorts of missiles, they're calculated as if to cause maximum effect and harm on the recipient, it seems to me. And here we have good old friend, I think former friend after this book review, Balding, who said that Shackle's worldview leads to total despair. Now, what's the worst thing that a Christian, or in a Judeo-Christian thing you can have? It's the opposite of hope, despair. We can debate whether it's pride or despair, which is the worst, but despair is a real no-no. And here we have the Quaker Balding accusing the Christian, devout Christian, Shackle, as encouraging despair. Now, Shackle's reply that he road-tested in letters and ultimately published was that unknowledge does not mean unhope. Just because you don't know, it doesn't mean you're ignorant. You just don't know the future, but that doesn't mean you feel a lack of hope, i.e. despair. And it does raise interesting issues of Christian theology about the relationship between hope, faith and doubt, that doubtless fill books that I mention in the printed version of the paper. And Balding goes on. He said, look, George, your view of God is that he's arbitrary and unpredictable and you can't work out what's going to happen in the future. We're just corks bobbing in an ocean of fate. Gee, this is a rather unpleasant God you're portraying, George. And there's a painting there, God, Man Proposes, God Disposes, that I've got there on slide 29. Essentially, you can go to the, you can plan on your trip to the North Pole, but you'll be savaged by polar bears. And Mark Perlman came to Shackle's defence. I won't spend too much time on this because time is starting to press. But he argues that there is a theological angle to where Shackle is coming from. And it's not one based on despair. It's based on a view of man's relationship with the divine. Now, Jacob wrestled with the angel. And the point about that is that the angel was able to wound Jacob, but did not pin him down. So fate and the gods cannot impose their will on man. We are free to make our own decisions. Bloodied and bruised, but we still have that freedom and power of individual and dignity of autonomous decision-making. And the punchline that Perlman adds, Shackle is profoundly aware of man's ability to handle uncertainty and is consciously less afraid of destiny's possible cruel grip on man, less afraid, that is, than Balding. So Balding is perhaps the one who doesn't trust that God has set the system up properly. A nice little counterpunch. Well, home stretch. What I'm doing in my work and in this paper is that I'm putting Shackle, in a sense, on the couch. I'm trying to get inside the man's head with a view to helping ascertain what's on the written page. And that may actually be a slightly controversial exegetical method, where you're supposed to be, I think, text-driven. But we've found that the approach works well with Keynes. If we look at his early life and his attitudes and the Bloomsbury and so on, we do get a much more accurate picture of his economics. And maybe we should be doing the same with George Shackle as well. Now, when you look at Shackle, you find some odd things, or seemingly odd things, about Shackle. He describes people as making these momentous decisions in life, the brave investor making heroic, life-changing decisions. You're wondering if why it is that he seemed exactly the opposite sort of person to the person that he spent his life writing about. Because he's the quiet, shy, cultivated professor who didn't exactly seem the man of adventure and mystery. I'm just observing that there seems to be a contrast between the people he was describing and the man himself. But when you think about it, we all make crucial decisions, particularly if you're a Christian, you're making crucial decisions every day. And another psychological dimension to Shackle is that he tended to admire people who are unlike himself. Instead of being a nihilist who thought that, oh, it's all hopeless, business people have no criteria for making decisions, on the contrary, he admired applied business people and thought they're the people you should talk to, that economists should talk to learn something about the world rather than perhaps to abstract theoreticians. And he admired applied economists. I said he did an early stint. Well, he did some early work in accumulating statistics, which occurred to me lately that's not the same as applied economics, really. So perhaps he never himself has done the things that he admires in others. And another psychological trait is that he wanted the irreconcilable to be reconciled. He wanted beauty and harmony and order, at least in the way we thought about the world. And that pervades his entire work. It suffuses everything. So there are other ways of looking at his life's work in terms of reconciling intellectually the work that the economics of Keynes and the economics of the Austrians. People take, like Greg Hill, argue that, well, perfectly intelligently, that Keynes's macroeconomics is wedded to Austrian microeconomics. Sounds good. But I think there's deeper stuff going on than that type of intellectual synthesis. This is what Shackle wrote about Hayek's Prices and Production of 1931. I'm sure it's in English in his Banco Lavoro article, but it's a lot sexier in Italian. My Italian isn't good enough, but he describes his state of excitation and how seductive and enigmatic he found that book. Believe me, he would be alone in finding that book describable in those terms. But it does show the Socratic and Platonic eros that people obtain in the pursuit of knowledge. These ideas captivate you and you fall in love with them. The fact that these are ways you'd usually describe a woman is also interesting, particularly in view of my windmill theatre allusion earlier. Around the same time too, early 1930s. So I think if you think that Hayek is sexy, you should be on the couch. And another aspect of Shackle's psychology that's very important to understanding his work is how single-minded he was. He ignored criticism. Even if his friends suggested, why don't you do it this way or that, he did not deviate. If people did not understand plan A, he said, OK, I'll try another tack. But the goal was always exactly the same. And this reflects, I think, his kind of mystical insight. When you've had a mystical insight that, oh, expectations are non-distributable, there's deep uncertainty, the world is not a machine, that's what you cling on to for the rest of your life, regardless of what the book reviewers say. I mention Agatha Christie because that's in an article that he wrote in 1984, where he talks about Agatha Christie gaining her inspiration over the kitchen sink. Well, obviously he felt that that applied also to him. He was a creature of inspiration, and he said that his idea of potential surprise that he wrote his book about in 1977 was germinated in an inspiration in 1937. So this is Meister Eckhart style of going on. And the article is from a journal that Gabriel Pastrello very kindly translated for me over coffee at the Buttery just a week or so ago. So the last point I want to make of substance about Shackle is that he still, throughout his career, loved mathematics. And he would try to bring in mathematics. He used prose as his first line of attack, and when he thought he had pinned down the problem, he always tried to use mathematics. And that was always an artistic and persuasive failure, rhetorical failure. The maths just never caught on. But we remember Shackle for his prose and his poetry. And this is the dream of the Platonist, of course, is ultimately to come up with the crystalline mathematical truths. Even if the mathematics is of fuzzy sets that Shackle thought may be the way to go to try to marry uncertainty and the clarity of mathematics. Even if it's any mathematics would do, but he failed in his life quest to come up with a mathematics. So the final Platonic Holy Grail eluded him. And here is what I've been trying to say over the last 45 minutes. Shackle begins with a world view that expectations are inherently unruly in an uncertain world. He looks at Keynes's general theory and thinks that Keynes has not adequately expressed it either intellectually or aesthetically. Along the way, he's been accused of nihilism by people who didn't understand where Shackle was coming from. I'm not sure that Shackle succeeded in coming up with a better economics than Keynes did. Interesting and charming as it is, I think they remain equal contenders at very least, and you can probably tell that I still give the nod to Keynes. Shackle's approach to Keynes and to economics in general was aesthetic. His Scheme of Economic Theory is one book that lays that aesthetic out. And I think that his Christian Neoplatonism suffuses not only that book, but his life's work. And I thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Bruce. I think that was a beautiful presentation and clearly a work of art. Please do call me.
Thank you.
As I said at the beginning, I have a few prepared points that I'd like to make and ask Bruce to respond to them, and then we'll open up the discussion. Since I know something about Keynes's general theory but not a lot about Shackle's work, my formal comments will be brief. It does seem to me that the Keynes problem in Shackle's thought is yet another reflection of the confusion there has been since the publication of the general theory over Keynes's treatment of time and equilibrium. Bruce tells us that Shackle's main criticism of Keynes was the contrast between Keynes's model, in which expectations were held constant until a new equilibrium is obtained, and the real world, in which expectations are restless and volatile. And this seems to me a misreading by Shackle of the nature of equilibrium in the general theory, though, of course, he was far from alone in that. And it underlines why it is so important to try and resolve this point, which has come up more than once in this seminar, series of seminars. If Keynes's short period equilibrium is a matter of the present moment and is achieved instantaneously, or on a daily basis, as I've argued elsewhere, there is, I think, no conflict between the model and the real world. The kaleidoscope can be turned every morning, and yet we still find ourselves in a new equilibrium. Indeed, I've always liked Shackle's metaphor because it seemed to me to capture very well that concept of shifting equilibrium. And this does mean that Keynes's long-period equilibrium, to which the system and the capital stock will converge over time if the state of expectation remains unchanged, long-period equilibrium may have little practical relevance if Shackle is right that in life expectations are restless and volatile. The lack of emphasis on dynamics in the general theory is therefore not a defect. Long-period equilibrium with its associated dynamics in mechanical time, as you put it, are mainly important for theoretical completeness only. Yet at the end of the general theory, of chapter 12 of the general theory, Keynes cautions us that the state of long-term expectation is often steady, and that we should not conclude that everything depends on waves of irrational psychology. So maybe long period equilibrium does sometimes occur in expectational time. But either way, employment is always determined as a matter of short period equilibrium by the state of expectation at any time. So that seems to me to reconcile what appears to be irreconcilable. But what I do not understand, although you have shed some light on this, is why Shackle, having made those criticisms, would then regard the use of the Swedish ex ante ex post method and the concept of a dynamic multiplier as somehow an improvement on Keynes. It seems to me to fall into the very trap that Keynes avoids, using his principle of effective demand and his logical multiplier, which I think we both agree are entirely static short period constructions based on short term rational expectations. Whereas the formation of long term expectations, which I think is where post Keynesians have located uncertainty for the most part, seems to me at any rate to require a quite different kind of theory and takes us into territory explored to some extent by Keynes in chapter 22 of the General Theory when he talks about the trade cycle and moves outside an equilibrium model. And of course explored by George Shackle and Brian Loseby and other such. So perhaps you can help us further with that second point.
I've got a reply that to some extent hits the ball back, but I think that's allowable.
That's
indeed encouraged, I hope. The first point is I sighed with pleasure when you said it's as though the kaleidoscope is turned every morning. I think that cuts through a lot of intricate analytical language and formal language to make a point assimilable. And I happen to particularly appreciate that type of point because I argue that metaphor is important not only in Shackle, but important as a means of communication between people in general and economists in particular, and that we don't pay enough attention to the metaphors that we use. And we should actually put metaphors to work, and that's exactly what Mark has just done. He's taken Shackle's metaphor and given it a, well, metaphorical twist, so that we learn something extra by contemplating the metaphor. Playing with the metaphor actually helps us understand what the metaphor is alluding to. It's not just a... it doesn't just capture a small trivial fragment of reality. It's actually a model of reality that we can play with and learn something about the more complex analogous reality that it represents. And I don't think we play enough with our metaphors in economics. The question that I have almost to bounce back at Mark is, how long is the duration of the multiplier? Is your interpretation of Keynes is that it happens within the day? If the kaleidoscope is turned in the morning, if investors wake up one morning feeling pessimistic, does that mean that the kaleidoscope tumbles, including the consumption sector, and the consumption sector automatically jumps to the correct consumption level in the same day? And another sort of suggestion is that it would be easier for me to get my head around Mark's arguments if we had a kind of a matrix, because you've got short period and long period, and you've got short period equilibrium and short period expectations, and there are four possible combinations, it seems to me. I'm going, okay, and it's just nice if you could say, well, in this cell here, this is what applies, and in that cell here and that cell here. And that would make it a lot easier for students, by the way, because instead of having a long prose account, you'd actually have a simple summary at the top of the page. And I'm always wondering whether I'm using the term short period when I should be saying short term or short... what's the other one? Short run? That's another term that gets thrown around. And as a result, economists simply can't communicate with each other if none of us is really sure what these words mean, because it's quite clear that you regard Keynes as being very careful about distinctions between period expectations and period equilibria. So that's more of a suggestion in return and a question thrown in.
Thank you. Well, thanks, Bruce, for the compliment about the metaphor. And you're quite right about the matrix idea. I need to think about how to present this better in a textbook format. But let me turn to your main question. How long does the multiplier take? I mean, what an innocent-sounding question, and yet what a hornet's nest it opens up. My view is that, for Keynes, the multiplier is an equilibrium relation between investment, consumption, and income. And that means it holds continuously, as Keynes himself states. However, it takes time for the capital stock, and therefore for employment, to adjust after a change in the state of expectation. Thus, I would say that after the kaleidoscope has been twisted, what we and Keynes think of as the normal value of the multiplier holds in the long period equilibrium corresponding to today's new state of expectation. On the way towards that, the multiplier still holds each day, but current investment and the propensity to consume change as the capital stock and employment change. Thus, both multiplier and multiplicand vary during the convergence. And this actually demonstrates rather helpfully the theoretical value of the concept of Keynes's long period equilibrium, even if in practice that long period equilibrium may be shifting each day. The conventional view of the multiplier is as a process through time, much as Kahn described it in 1931. Thus, the multiplier is seen as part of the process of formation of expectations. Whereas for Keynes, on my reading, a new state of expectation can be set up each new day, and the convergence is in the capital stock, not in expectations. This may seem rather a fine point, but what is at stake is that the conventional story cannot explain what price expectations the process converges to. The conventional story has no supply side and assumes, necessarily, fixed prices. Keynes, I know, does not assume fixed prices, and I hold that the principle of effective demand is itself a theory of the formation of expected prices as short-term rational expectations.